Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David Latulip. This week, conversations with director Christopher White and Teddy Hulsker of the Bay Area theater group Mugwumpin, who will share some of the apocalyptic detail of their latest endeavor, The Great Big Also. We'll have a live performance from members of the early music group Canzonier. Plus, for 2013, our new feature on the first Thursday of each month, a look at the classical music month ahead with music critic Joshua Cosman. Stay with us. To begin today's program, I'm joined now by Christopher White, co-founder and artistic director of Mugwumpin, and the creator of their latest performance piece, The Great Big Also, and by Teddy Hulsker, who is the sound designer for the piece. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you very much for having us.
Chris, I have to first ask, Mugwumpin.
It's always the first question.
Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, baby.
We derived it from the word mugwump, which was a part of the Republican Party back at the start of the 20th century. And they were a part of the Republican Party that refused to toe the party line. And I think it's derived from a Native American word for like big chief or something like that. And then it became a sort of derogatory term for a politician who's got his mug on one side of the fence and his wump on the other. Okay. And we just love the sound of it.
I do too. And heck, we just got a history lesson. Now, this show is called The Great Big Also. Mm-hmm. Now, how did you come up with that title? There's some, we can talk about the themes later on, but where did this title come from?
Well, the title actually came pretty late in the process of creating the piece. We were tossing around a lot of different possibilities for titles around this idea of American prophecy, which is sort of the central theme of the show. And the show had developed into being about this quasi-religious sect that believes that this great rift is coming where our plane of reality is going to split in two, and sort of they want to get on board with this new plane that's coming. And so I just happened to say something in rehearsal to the cast about, you know, it's like this other plane. It's like the great big also, the other possibility. And the cast was like, that's it. That's the title.
Well, how did the inspiration for this theme come up? This is based on maybe some reality shows like Doomsday Preppers that you see on National Geographic, or that marvelous religious guy who was like predicting the end of the world.
And that's definitely part of it. Harold Camping.
Who could forget Harold Camping?
Exactly. We started planning this piece way back in early 2011, and we were discussing what theme we wanted to approach. We create all of our work from scratch without a script as an ensemble, and so we usually start with some sort of theme or something like that that we start to do research on, start to just go into the room and play and riff on. And we said, oh, well, this piece, you know, we're going to be making it during 2012. We should absolutely make the theme apocalypse, but it seemed a little bit too much on the nose. So we started discussing what might sort of be parallel to that that's even more interesting and has more long-term resonance than just apocalypse. And so we started talking about prophetic traditions in America. And the more we researched, the more fascinated we became. I particularly got hooked on the Shakers because as they were sort of growing in strength as a religious movement in the U.S., it was right during the American Civil War. And so as the new Americans were inventing this country and fighting for their religious freedom, this sect was also being persecuted for being sort of too radically inclusive. And we just, those kinds of traditions and the ways that they've influenced America from our very earliest history and continue to influence us now just really fascinated us.
That's Chris White. He's talking about the world premiere of The Great Big Also, which is going to be at the Z Space coming up. Information at zspace.org. Now, I think every generation, as you mentioned, has been waiting for the end of the world in some way.
That's true.
People have been critical of that or looking forward to it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is this kind of poking fun at those types of things? Is it in sympathy with folks that
I would say it's a little of both. And I think that if we're doing our job correctly, then the audience both has an opportunity to laugh at the ridiculousness of it and the ridiculousness really of parts of it, but then in other parts to really see themselves and really see within that impulse for the apocalypse that there's really an impulse for renewal and for change and revolution and a way out of sort of the dead ends that we often find ourselves in individually and as a society.
I can see the sympathetic end of it because I think in the back of some people's minds, my own included, is like, oh, good, the end of the world. Kind of a sense of relief, you know, maybe hoping that the end of the world really was going to happen. Brand New Year. Or
absolutely.
Camping's
and, this group has sort of given themselves a way out in a way, and they see this rift that's coming as an opportunity to shift over to a new America. So while this America, in their eyes, is driving itself into the ground, they're going to be able to start over and really live the American ideals as they were enshrined and promised in our founding documents.
Teddy Halsker is joined by you. He's the sound designer for the piece. Teddy, and Chris for that matter, there's some sounds that are actually part of inspiring this whole concept of the work. What are those? Where do these sounds come from?
Actually, a friend showed me the sounds. It's a between 2011 and 2012, there was all these instances of people recording unexplained sounds sort of emanating from the sky. Without a real central focus point. And, you know, like anything unexplained, it was associated with end times, particularly because it was 2011, 2012. And I was hearing these sounds, and they are a little unsettling. Whether or not there's any factual basis or what really they are, I can't say. But I was very... The idea of something, of an unexplained sound, was very appealing to me and seemed very correct for this show.
You brought a couple of them with you.
Let's hear
one of them. What are we going to hear first?
So the first thing we'll hear is the first sound I heard that led me to the finding more of these sounds.
Sound being incorporated into the great big also. Wow, that wasn't a created sound. That was a natural sound somewhere.
Yeah.
No wonder it was inspiring people to say, what's behind that cloud?
Yeah.
Where was this recorded?
Oregon. Yeah, in 2012.
And was it ever explained?
The closest thing, and I'm probably going to butcher this, I'm not a scientist at all, but I think it had something to do with elements in our atmosphere sort of shifting. And so... When I listen to it as a sound person, what it makes me think of is actually feedback. And actually, if you play another sound, you kind of can really hear that.
Again, a sound heard in nature that is making people look up in the sky and wonder, is this the end times? So how did you incorporate this into your overall sound design?
Well, I wanted to create an environment that was undergoing change and in a sense of change on a very natural scale, which can be when we look at like mountains being created, earthquakes, oceans and valleys and rifts. I wanted to create that sense of like a geological change. The entire environment is pulling apart or coming together to make a new landscape. And particularly, I drew from that because I think in the American experience, the landscape is something that is very important to us. And I think that's something that can be found kind of universally as the American experience is our landscape. So I wanted to kind of create that sense of the landscape shifting.
And it's also a strong element in the scenic design of the piece as well. The audience is actually embedded inside of the design with the performers, and the set is actually constructed from three stories of Tyvek, which is that sort of papery material FedEx envelopes are made out of.
House coatings for that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And the space just is continually shifting around the audience in totally unexpected ways, and Teddy's sound design does a really fantastic job of reflecting that sense of instability.
Now, tell me about this year of research and smaller experiments that led into the creation of this larger work. You mentioned it was a collaborative process, but why a full year of working towards this piece?
Well, when we start without a script and just with an idea for a theme, we're really starting from nothing at all. And so it really takes time for, A, the whole ensemble to figure out what it is that we're making and how we're going to integrate our research. And we have a pretty unique process as well, in the sense that we have had Teddy involved in the process pretty much the whole time, building sound along with building scenes. And it just takes so much longer than you would ever expect to create a full show when you're starting from whole cloth.
So is the audience actively participating in this, or is this thing everything happening around them?
It's really important to us. A lot of our work involves the audience. We want to make work that really is a live experience for the people who are there. And at the same time, it's important to us that we don't put the audience on the spot in a way that they haven't really agreed to. It always feels coercive to us when you go to a show and somebody says, okay, now you stand up and do blah, blah, blah. And so the audience is certainly implicated, and they're certainly going to make contact with the performers, and the performers are going to talk directly to them. But nothing obnoxious is going to be asked of the audience.
Okay. Well, let's hear how all this sound comes together in the final mix.
Yes.
Teddy, explain to us what we're going to hear on this track.
So what we're going to hear is some elements from the show, including the unexplained sounds. There's also going to be some voice recordings from two of the actors in the show. As part of the development of the piece, they recorded personal messages to the people they were leaving behind once the shift occurred. And so these are wrapped into this soundscape that you're about to hear.
Sound design of The Great Big Also by Teddy Halsker, who's collaborating with Chris White, who is co-founder and artistic director of Mugwumpin. The Great Big Also, on an apocalyptic theme, can be seen at Z Space. It's in preview tonight and tomorrow night. And then opening night is this Saturday at 8 o'clock, and performances run through March 24th. Chris, Teddy, thanks for taking a little time today with explaining that it should be an incredible evening of theater.
I think so. Thank you so much for having us.
And we'll look forward to next year's Mugwumpin project.
Great.
soundscape for you here on KLW. That was music of the early music ensemble Cansonnier, who joined me in the studio now to be introduced shortly. First, I'm going to be talking with Tim Rayborn, who is the director and founder of the ensemble. Tim was American-born musician and singer who's well accomplished in music not only of the Middle East and North Africa, Central Asia, Turkey, Iran, the Balkans. He and his guests, fellow members of Cansonnier, are no strangers to these airwaves either. They've been guests on Folk Music and Beyond with Joanne Marr, as well as Sarah Cahill and Then and Now. So I welcome you to the 1 o'clock hour on KLW 10.
Thank you.
So tell me a little bit about this very interesting program you've got. This is under the auspices of the San Francisco Early Music Society. You're presenting with Choreomania, Music for the Dancing Plagues of Medieval and Renaissance Europe. That's quite a theme.
Indeed, yes. I read a book a couple of years ago about this phenomenon, and I got to thinking that it would make a fascinating concert program. It's actually a medical term, choreomania, and it refers to the wild, uncontrollable compulsion to dance, and it often has a mass hysteria quality to it, where for reasons unknown, people will begin dancing and then others will begin joining them. There's a number of incidences throughout medieval history and into the Renaissance where there are actual documented cases of this happening, where someone, in particular the case of Strasbourg in 1518, this elderly woman just stepped outside of her home one day and began tapping her feet and dancing, and before too long, within a couple of weeks, other people were doing it, and they would just dance for hours uncontrollably, and no one really knows why. There have been a number of theories put forward, from mass hysteria to ergot poisoning to penitential guilt or anything, but we really don't know why it happened.
Almost seems like the Salem witch trials that happened.
Not a bad analogy, actually. Yeah. It's very strange, and at one point it was thought by certain town officials and such at various points that instead of trying to quell it, if they provided musicians to play for them, that perhaps they would sort of dance it out of their systems and be done with it. It wasn't, curiously enough, it wasn't viewed as a demonic possession sort of thing, but rather as a saint's curse. It was viewed that they'd done something wrong, and so either St. John the Baptist or St. Vitus had cursed them and was making them dance. And there are cases of people making pilgrimages to shrines, dancing all the way up, going to the shrine, and then being healed and coming back normal, which, again, suggests the mass hysteria aspect to it.
Well, let's hear a little bit of music live now here in the KLW studios, and then we'll talk some more about the program and introduce you to not only the other musicians you have with you, but the instruments that they brought along. This is music of Cansonnier here on Open Air.
Thank you.
Live from the KLW studios, Music of Canzonier, presenting concerts tomorrow at First Lutheran Church in Palo Alto, Saturday at St. John's Presbyterian in Berkeley, and Sunday at St. Mark's Lutheran here in San Francisco. Fantastic music, Tim.
Thank you
for bringing these folks in. Kindly introduce me to the instrumentalists you brought along, and the singer, for that matter.
Splendid group of people that I'm always happy to work with. We have Shira Kamen playing the viol and also doing harp and voice. We have Phoebe Yevtovich, who is our splendid lead vocalist and singer. And we have a guest for this concert from the East Coast, Priscilla Smith, who is an amazing recorder and bagpipe player.
Well, welcome all.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
Perhaps we could talk a little bit about the viol and what makes it different from an instrument we would normally hear in modern times.
Well, actually, one thing.
Hold it up to the microphone.
You hear it now?
Can you see it? There we go. Okay.
It actually looks a lot cooler than a violin.
It does.
These instruments weren't standardized, as you can imagine. All instruments in the Middle Ages would not have been. So when you see pictures and statues of viols, they have anywhere from 3 to 6 strings. Some of them, perhaps, drone strings. Sometimes these instruments are depicted with frets. We have none left to play on, so we have to go to a modern instrument maker and ask them if they would maybe look at a picture or a statue on a cathedral, and then also make something that will fit in an overhead bin. my personal viol
just fascinated to hear recently that the TSA is now allowing you to bring 2 golf clubs. pocket knife, only a certain size.
It'd be great if they would say you can bring 2 medieval instruments.
At no extra seat charge.
Exactly. This viol has 5 strings, all Ds and Gs. And they're gut strung, so it's got a slightly more nasal sound. If you could see it, a highly arched bow, like an archery bow.
I'll give you a little bit of Carnegie Hall here, but let's hear just a little bit alone of the viol.
All right.
Marvelous sound on that, and a very different type of bow than you see. But it sounds like a full bow there. Maybe it's Carnegie helping there.
Yeah. If they'd had reverb, they would have used it.
Priscilla, you're trained as an oboist. Tell me how you came to the recorders. Did you start off as a recorderist in grade school, as I did,
exactly.
And then moved to flute, and moved to oboe?
Well, okay. I actually liked playing hot cross buns. And I was being from any big city, you can do things like take private recorder lessons. And I'm from Philadelphia, and that's what
I've heard of Philadelphia.
Yeah, it's on the other side.
Yeah.
And I picked up modern oboe only because I went to an arts high school, and I auditioned on recorder, and they said, well, we'll take you, but there's nothing for you to do here. So then I went and got my undergrad in modern oboe, and then added on sort of, before I did anything Baroque, which is what I do almost most of the time now, I added on Renaissance instruments other than recorders, so shams. And in this 20-minute segment, you'll only hear recorders, but I am also playing a little bagpipe. Not a loud Highland bagpipe.
Okay, okay. Well, let's hear the instrument. Hopefully you're playing Baroque, but you're not Baroque.
I'm playing. This. I know, I'm not very good. These actually, they do look more like something you'd be familiar with, but the instruments that I'm playing are Renaissance, copies of Renaissance recorders. So if you could see it, the little sort of curly cues you get on the instruments that your fourth grader plays,
mm-hmm.
That look Baroque, these don't have that, have them. They have a much bigger low end, and not as many chromatics and not as high, but they don't need to go so high. That this music isn't as rangy as later on, as a Vivaldi concerto would need to be. So this, it looks a little bit more straight. It looks more like a tube with holes in it, and that's what it is. But,
mm-hmm. And this particular one is about a foot long?
This one, yes, soprano size. And all these instruments came in families. That was one of the names of the game in the Renaissance. I've got a soprano and a tenor with me.
Let's just hear a little bit from the soprano, then we'll introduce the tenor. Lovely.
And then an octave lower is my tenor. And an interesting thing about the recorders is they're called an octave lower than what they sound. So the tenor is actually a soprano woman's voice. So if I'm playing in unison with Phoebe on the tenor, we're actually in unison, and the soprano is an octave higher. So,
Brings us to Phoebe.
Which brings us to Phoebe.
Hi.
Hey, Phoebe. What brought you to this era of music?
Well, I started out in high school as a jazz person. I was really loving that repertoire. And then when I went to college, I was lucky to be in a place where there was a wonderful Collegium Musicum, a really good professor who encouraged me to do early music.
Where was that? Let's get a shout out to him.
University of Louisville.
There we go.
Professor Jack Ashworth is responsible for all of this. Thank you. And darn you.
For the Baroque end of things, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Very nice. Tim, I'm wondering if you could share with me a little bit about how you find this music.
That's an interesting question. There's actually a lot of music that does survive. People, I think, tend to think that medieval music is just Gregorian chants and nothing else, but there are a staggering amount of secular pieces that survive. Not too many instrumental pieces. We have something like less than 50 dances before the year 1430, but it's rather remarkable that they were written down at all. A lot of instrumental music and dance music was actually made by taking existing vocal pieces and creating new instrumental music off of them. So one of the things that's fun about being in a medieval group is that you get to become a kind of medieval musician and create your own new dance music or your own new instrumental pieces. We're reviving a tradition as much as playing old music, and that's part of the fun. So when looking at things, there are pieces we can use, certainly, but there's also this vast repertoire of other songs that we can draw from and say, hey, that melody would make a really fun dance piece or an interesting instrumental intro to something.
In this day and age, do you need to actually go to these libraries, or can you find some of this stuff online?
Some's online. There are transcriptions, of course, into modern notation, but a lot of these are now available in facsimile editions as well, because music notation that we can read with confidence dates back to the 12th century, and quite a few of them are now available. Some of those are available online as well now, mm-hmm. or in extremely expensive full-color editions, which one can buy. So it's often fun to reconstruct things off of the original page. It gives you a different feel for what the music sounds like, rather than some modern editor's interpretation.
And then given the plethora of music that you'll come across, how do you separate the pearls from the swine, so to speak?
Trial and error.
It's
what you like. It's what you think works. And sometimes we try pieces and they don't work.
Can you see on the page something that says, oh, this is not...
I'll maybe silently kind of sing through it and see if something steps out at me. I don't know what you do, Shira, but I kind of look at things and, oh, that could work. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The Berklee Music Library is really fantastic.
Mm,
if you want to delve into the stuff, you can just go there and start browsing and come out 3 years later.
Right. A lot of these libraries are online now, though, so you don't have to fly to Dusseldorf in order to, which you did have to do.
Well, that could be fun, though.
Yeah.
An excuse to go to Germany or France.
Yeah, right? Yes. You can do that. Yeah.
Well, let's hear some more music, and I'll let you adjust the mics while I just reintroduce where you can catch this music.
Do a couple of pieces that aren't actually dances but come from the same time period as one of the dancing plagues. Do you want to say anything about Insaeculum, Shira? You know a little bit more about
it. Sure. Okay, medieval music is really awesome. It starts out with this chant.
She's biased.
And you have this string of notes with no rhythm, and then the string of notes with no rhythm gets chopped up in a rhythmic pattern, and other parts get organized and composed above it. And so this is a piece called Insaeculum Viella Torus. So the tenor line, the bottom line, is from a chant called Insaeculum, and it's one of the only pieces that actually has the word viel in the title. So we like to say this is the Insaeculum of the viel player, or Insaeculum vielosaurus, as we like to call it in the 21st century.
And Tim, you're using you put the drum down,
yes.
You were playing earlier. What are you playing now?
This is a psaltery, P-S-A-L-T-E-R-Y. It's a type of zither with wire strings that derives from a Middle Eastern instrument called the kanun, which is still played in the Middle East. It's related to the hammer dulcimer, and you can see it's shaped a bit like an auto harp.
Everyone
it's
see
also
that?
It's also the ancestor of the harpsichord and the piano, as you can see by the shape.
Ah, okay, great. Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear some music of Canzonier once again live in the KLW studios. Thank you. Music of the early music ensemble Canzonier presenting Choromania tonight or tomorrow night in Palo Alto, Saturday in Berkeley, Sunday at San Francisco. Wow, fantastic sounds. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Of course. We have a special ticket offer today. If you go to the website sfems.org and type in the code KALW, your tickets will be half price. Go to sfems.org for this very special concerts. Canzonier offering these music of the for dancing plagues of medieval and Renaissance Europe this weekend. sfems.org for half price tickets, entering KALW at the very end. It's the first Thursday of the month, and for 2013, we've started a new feature on Open Air with music critic Joshua Cosman, who's here to share a few picks for the month ahead. Welcome back, Joshua.
Thank you, David.
Sure. Well, you've got a couple of chamber music groups on your nice list for the month of March. You want to share some
of those? Some are nice and some are nasty. That's true. There's a lot of orchestra music going on this month in the Bay Area, and one of them that I'm particularly looking forward to is a two-night stand in Berkeley by the Australian Chamber Orchestra. This is a brilliant small string ensemble led by a violinist named Richard Tognetti, who they've been coming around periodically for a number of years, and I always look forward to their performances because they play with a wonderful kind of robust ensemble sound that still has a lot of transparency, and they have a great range of repertoire. I also have to say there's a kind of a Pavlovian good association with me, because the first time they came here was with up in a concert with the late Lorraine Hunt Lieberson at a time when she was still Lorraine Hunt, and she sang a couple of Handel arias that were still among my most cherished musical memories, even counting other performances I heard of hers. So whenever they come around, it's always a welcome sight. They're doing two nights. They're doing a night of all Russian music, Prokofiev, Shostakovich, and Tchaikovsky, and then another night of music by Handel and, I'm sorry, by Haydn, and introducing a new concerto for electric violin by the Australian composer Brett Dean, whom they've championed in the past. I should mention in the first night, the Russian program, the Shostakovich first piano concerto is going to be played by the German-Japanese pianist Elise Sarah Ott. So that's going to be a great program, two nights in Berkeley, courtesy of Cal Performances.
That's in Hertz Hall on the UC Berkeley campus, again under the auspices of Cal Performances. More information and details at calperformances.org for those March 22nd and 23rd concerts of the Australian Chamber Orchestra. Another chamber group that is in town is called Alarm Will Sound. What do you know about them?
They're a terrific, very vital New York group that plays contemporary music of all kinds. Very adventurous, very, very virtuosic. Their leader is a guy named Alan Pearson, music director, I should say, who subsequently then took on another job as the music director of the Brooklyn Philharmonic, where he's been doing some very innovative programming. But the program that they're doing at Stanford in the Bing Concert Hall is devoted completely to music of Steve Reich. They're introducing a new piece by Reich, which is called Radio Rewrite, which is a treatment of music from the alt-rock band Radiohead.
Right, it incorporates two of their tunes, Everything in Its Right Place and Jigsaw Falling Into Place, and they make this rewrite out of it.
Sounds good. And so I'm looking forward to that. And then they're going to do Clapping Music, which is that great early piece of play of pure rhythmic byplay, just some number of people clapping in intricate patterns. And excerpts from The Cave, which is this wonderful multimedia piece that Reich and his wife, the video artist Beryl Kuro, did a number of years ago based on themes from Genesis about Abraham and his sons Isaac and Ishmael.
We actually have an excerpt from this Reich piece, Three Genesis Settings. Let's have a listen now.
Great.
That's an excerpt from one of three Genesis settings from The Cave, music of Steve Reich. It'll be performed by Alarm Will Sound at their concerts on Saturday, March 16th at the Bing Concert Hall. Well worth checking out that great new space if you haven't yet, to catch Alarm Will Sound. More information about them in general at alarmwillsound.com. Great choice of a venue and concert for coming up in March. What else we got?
Well, one other thing coming up this month is the last concert of the season by the Berklee Symphony under their music director, Joana Carneiro. She's really done a terrific job, I think, in the year or two, a couple of years since she's taken over. And she stepped into an interesting spot after that orchestra had such a long history and such a distinctive character with their former music director, Kent Nagano.
A continuing relationship, by the way. He's still coming back.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, it was certainly a thankless assignment to come in and try and do something that was not wholly different from what they've done and yet still chart her own path. And I think it's really been interesting to see how she's done that. And one of the things that she's done, a very interesting project this year, was in their four concerts, each of them has included a world premiere commission from a composer, some of them local. The first two were by Berklee composers, Paul Drescher, who's a very established composer, very important figure in Bay Area music, and Dylan Mattingly, who's about 20 or 21 years old and sort of right out of the Berklee high school system. And then she followed up with a piece by a Portuguese composer, Andrea Pinto Correo, whom she knew from Lisbon. And now finally, the last piece in this series is going to be a piece by the composer Stephen Stuckey, who I think is perhaps maybe the most established serious Bigfoot of that crowd, a Pulitzer Prize winner and former composer in residence with the Los Angeles Philharmonic. And he's written a piece called The Stars and the Roses for Tenor and Orchestra, which is a setting of poems by the Polish poet Czesław Miłosz,
who's also
a Berklee resident.
Nobel Prize winner and on the UC Berklee faculty.
So it all stays right at home. And the soloist for that is going to be a tenor named Noah Stewart, who was a very promising Adler Fellow at the San Francisco Opera some years ago. So I'm looking forward to that. They're doing that alongside Bruckner's Fourth Symphony.
Right, and that'll be on Thursday, March 28th. More information at berkeleysymphony.org. I should also mention, Joshua, that preceded by that 28th concert on Sunday, March 24th, the Berklee Symphony's Continued Under Construction series is going on, where Joanna and the orchestra showcase Bay Area composers, including on this round Andrew Lai's Lair, Michael Nicholas's The Wraith, and David Verrota, fascinating guy, composer, pianist, and UCSF mathematics professor, in addition to all the work he does in the musical fields. His work called Ultra Marinus will be performed at the Crowden Music Center on Sunday, March 24th. Again, details at berkeleysymphony.org.
And, of course, that concert and others are going to be broadcast here on KLW at some point. Isn't that right?
Right. The full symphony concert of the Bruckner and Stuckey will be broadcast in September here.
Great. So if you miss it, then you can wait around for another.
Hear it again.
Hear it again. There you go. There you go. Exactly so.
Well, a Bay Area institution is having its 35th anniversary this year. I wonder if you want to share your thoughts about Chanticleer.
That's true. It's sort of astonishing that it's been that long. Chanticleer was started in 78 as sort of around the dinner table of some local singers who knew each other from the San Francisco Symphony chorus. They had sung together there and the Grace Cathedral Choir. And they were sort of hanging around dinner, as I've been told. This is before my time, but you know, somebody said, "Well, we should get a group of people together to form a chorus to sing." And originally, the idea was to sing Renaissance polyphony, the great masses and motets and sacred music of Palestrina and others. And then it quickly ballooned into a whole range of other musics. And before too long, the chorus had its own touring schedule and a recording contract, and it had become sort of an institution, but it still has its roots right here in the Bay Area. And now this year marks its 35th anniversary, and there's going to be a concert to mark that on a couple of concerts, Friday on the 22nd of March at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. There's going to be a performance with guest artist Nellie Mackay, the pop singer, and a couple of other local choral groups, Clear Story and Muse. And then on Saturday, the 23rd, they'll be moving over to the Venetian Room.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Exactly. So a little something for everyone.
I guess I'm told that those concerts are sold out, but if you go to chanticleer.org, there's some information about getting on the wait list.
Exactly so. And it really... It's worth restating what an important institution that chorus has been over the years, and the range of music from not only early music but contemporary music. A lot of commissions that from local artists and others have come through that group. There was a period when they had a composer named Chen Yi, very important composer. She was here for a 3-year residency with the group and turned out a lot of very good music for them, and other composers have done as well.
There's some other concerts coming up in June, so you'll be able to catch Chanticleer at some point. Go to chanticleer.org to learn more. Now, the month of March doesn't include the announcement of the full season of 2013-14 of the San Francisco Symphony that was just announced at a press conference. Now, I'm wondering if you could maybe briefly share a couple things that struck your fancy for that, and then maybe we'll spend some more time on another show to
dive
a little
great.
Deeper.
Well, the sort of headline thing about this upcoming season is, of course, 2013 is the centenary of Benjamin Britten, the great English composer, and there's going to be a lot of Britten represented in the season, not all in 2013. They're going to spill it. It's the 2013-14 season, so some of the Britten celebrations are going to be during his 101st year in 2014, but we can overlook that because one of them is going to be a semi-staged performance of his great opera, Peter Grimes. This is the first time that Michael Tilson Thomas has conducted the piece, although he reminded us at a press conference the other day that he once prepared the chorus for it as a student, music student, and he could still sing all the parts, a fact which he proceeded to demonstrate. But the music of Britain has not been a very big part of the symphony's repertoire in the past. So this is going to really be a very welcome reparation of that. There's going to be Peter Grimes. MTT is also conducting music from the ballet Prince of the Pagodas, which is this great piece that Britain was inspired to write after traveling in Indonesia and hearing Balinese gamelan for the first time. And some of those sounds and some of those rhythms show up in that piece. So they're going to put that together with a performance by a local gamelan orchestra. Also, they're doing some other pieces. The War Requiem, which is that great choral masterpiece of his, and some others as well that are escaping.
Well, let's have an hour together on,
exactly,
on just Britain,
exactly,
and their upcoming performance.
The other thing that's of interest is they're going to devote three programs to the music of Mason Bates, the Oakland composer who's been really coming very much into his own in recent years, including a piece that he wrote last year for the Chicago Symphony called Alternative Energy, which I think was really one of the great new orchestral pieces of the last year. The Chicago Symphony played it here on tour, and now the San Francisco Symphony is going to take it over.
What interested me as well is in October they're going to be doing some live music to some Hitchcock films, too.
So exactly.
Interesting stuff ahead in this new season for the San Francisco Symphony. Well, finally today, Joshua, the Bay Area really lost a couple of luminaries in the landscape recently. I'm wondering if you could first share a couple of memories of Zheng Chao with us.
Zheng Chao, the mezzo-soprano who came through the San Francisco Opera Center, was an Adler Fellow, and then she went on to do a number of terrific performances and on the stage of the War Memorial Opera House. For a long time, she was almost typecast as Suzuki in Madama Butterfly. She was a role she sang a number of times, I think, to the point where it sort of started to chafe a little bit for her. But the problem was she was so damn good at it. It really was a role that brought out her great dramatic depth and the wonderful richness of her voice. And then finally, the last performance that she did for the opera, which was her biggest starring role, was as Ruth Kamen in The Bonesetter's Daughter, this piece that was commissioned from composer Stuart Wallace, based on the Amy Tan novel. And it was a role written very much for her and her history as an artist who was born in Shanghai, came to the United States, and the way that anybody who knew her, sort of, you always saw that blend of the old world and the new world. She was this wonderful kind of tough-talking broad, but with this always very heavy Chinese accent. So it was a wonderful, slightly incongruous combination of qualities that she had. And she was a terrific singer, and we're going to miss her very, very much.
I should mention that sfcv.org has a wonderful in memoriam section and an article called The Loss of Zheng Chao by Jason Serenas is quite lovely read. And in fact, as recently as February of this year, you know, she was suffering from cancer, but she appeared in an event that established the Marilla Opera Program Zheng Chao Opera Fund. The fund sponsors an incoming Marilla artist, either a mezzo-soprano or someone of Asian Pacific ancestry. SFCV.org is also where you can read a really touching memory of William Bennett, who passed away on stage performing the last night of his the Strauss Oboe Concerto. Jeff Kalis writes a wonderful article, which it's a touching treatment that veers from a standard memoriam in that it shares some stories and anecdotes from Bill's students. Mm-hmm. So it's really quite lovely. You've had a long association with hearing Bill.
I've always heard Bill. I've met him a few times and talked to him. But the thing about Bill is, you know, I've been covering the San Francisco Symphony now for 25 years and written hundreds of reviews. And I think about the number of times that I've sat at my computer and written and singled out William and principal oboist William Bennett. He whatever the concert was, whatever the piece was, there was always some little piece of magic that he provided. You know, he didn't do all that many solo turns. He played the Strauss a couple times. He played this concerto that John Harbison had written for him. He did, I think, one performance of the Mozart concerto. But whatever the orchestral repertoire was, there was always something that Bill would contribute that would sort of stand out from the performance and make you listen up with fresh attention and say, what's he doing with that? How's he going to make this moment special? And he always came through.
Well, the week of that concert, I think, was his last radio interview here, I think, at KLW. So we're going to repost just that segment of Open Air that was from February 21st as a part of this show. So if you haven't heard our talk with Bill Bennett, you can hear that at our website, klw.org. And to conclude, let's end with what Bill ended with, his Strauss Oboe Concerto performance. This from the Friday performance, Bill Bennett, performing the Strauss, an excerpt from the Strauss Oboe Concerto with the San Francisco Symphony. Thanks for being here, Joshua.
Thanks for having me, David.
Excerpt from the Richard Strauss Oboe Concerto. Thank you to the San Francisco Symphony for that recording. Live from Davies Symphony Hall, Bill Bennett in his final performance. I'm David LaTulipe. You've been listening to Open Air. I do want to mention a couple of other events that are going on. First of all, the earlier folks we had on Open Air today, Consonnier. I mentioned the tickets that you can get for a 50% discount if you go to sfems.org, San Francisco Early Music KALWSociety.org. If you enter KALW at checkout, you can have discount tickets for this weekend's performance of Canzonier, music for the dancing plagues of medieval and Renaissance Europe. Also, tomorrow, March 8th, is International Women's Day, and around that, San Francisco choral artists present Voices of Women, a program celebrating music by women and about women, dreamed up by one of the strongest advocates of new choral music in the Bay Area, Magan Solomon. Last weekend, they were at St. Gregory in San Francisco. This weekend, Saturday and Sunday, St. Mark's on Saturday in Palo Alto. Sunday, St. Paul's in Oakland. Information and tickets at sfca.org for those concerts. And a final bit of shameless self-promotion, this coming Monday at 1 o'clock out at San Francisco State University in Knuth Hall, I'll be the reciter for William Walton's Facade and Entertainment. The small ensemble includes members of the San Francisco Opera and Symphony, as well as the Santa Rosa Symphony and Alexander String Quartet, conducted by Cyrus Jinwala. This piece is a hoot and a half, William Walton's Facade. It's at 1 o'clock at San Francisco State, and information you can get at musicdance.sfsu.edu. Once again, musicdance.sfsu.edu. sfsu.edu. We'll put those links and others at our website, kalw.org, in the open air section. I'm David LaTulipe. An hour of news from the BBC is next. The time is 2 o'clock.